Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Several weeks ago, one of our Japanese viewers asked if I would do a video about Pearl Harbor and about how Japan was brought into World War II. Because in one of my earlier videos, I had said that the Japanese were tricked into World War II. So our Japanese viewer was interested in knowing my views on how Japan was brought into World War II. So my first problem was to get a certain source, because one of my friends had alerted me to this more than a year ago, and I wanted to get his specific information for this series of videos about Japan and World War II. And in the end, I got quite a stack of information. I even found information that I didn't know I had. So, I actually wanted to change the title of my video about Japan entering World War II, because I think it is incorrect, it is wrong, to say that the Japanese were tricked into World War II. It is more accurate to say the Japanese were bullied into World War II. The Japanese were kicked and shoved and pushed into a corner before they went on the attack. The Japanese, like the Germans, did not enter World War II lightly. They were set up, and we're going to study that. So while I began work on the video about Japan entering World War II, I was busy recording, and then I decided I needed to tell the viewers something about FDR, about President Roosevelt of America. And just a note for your information, in Rhodesia and South Africa, we have lots of schools that are named after Roosevelt. In Rhodesia, I went to a high school named after Winston Churchill. In Rhodesia, at the school that I went to, we had two high schools, and they weren't co-ed, I might add. So we had a boys' high school next to a girls' high school. And I must tell you, I think that that idea is not a bad way of doing things. I do think that boys and girls need to learn certain things separately. Anyway, the boys' high school was called Churchill, and the girls' high school was called Roosevelt, named after FDR. But here in South Africa, on my way to work, I drive past a school that's named also after Roosevelt. And the suburb I live in is named after General Montgomery of the English in World War II. So all across Southern Africa, we dumb whites have been lauding all these English and this one American who were so wonderful in World War II. And just today, a black guy from Zimbabwe sent me an email showing me that Lord Mandelson in England, and Lord Mandelson is a Jew. And the article he sent me was that Lord Mandelson is bailing out the communist scumbag Robert Mugabe who runs Zimbabwe. Now, for every Rhodesian, Robert Mugabe is the enemy. We hate him, we wish we'd killed him, and the only thing we are sorry about is that we didn't kill him. So here is a Jew from England, a Jew from the upper classes of England, busy bailing out a communist. Aha! England! England is always assisting the communists. Yet, to the dummies here in Southern Africa, to the dumb whites of Southern Africa, and that includes all of us, and I include myself, we believed that England and America fought against communism. But, as I said to some Rhodesians today, and to some Afrikaners, I sent them the email about this Jew, Lord Mandelson, and I said to them, there you go, there you go. There's England at it again. England always supporting communists, and Jews created communism. And remember when England supported that guy? What's his name? Good old Uncle Joe. Ah, Joseph Stalin, the mass murderer. Good old guy. And they taught the children in America and England what a good guy he was. Communist mass murderer. So I sent this email to these Rhodesians and I said to them, look there. Do you see? England is the enemy of all Rhodesians, and Rhodesians need to wake up to the fact that just as England has been the enemy of the Boers for the last 200 years, so too is England the enemy of Rhodesians, and actually other whites as well, like the Portuguese in Africa, whom we've not even begun to discuss. You will find that these English have worked incessantly against the whites of Africa for the last 200 years. And the Rhodesians are just the latest casualties in this war. The Rhodesians, because they didn't hand over the country to the blacks and they decided to resist blacks and communism and globalism, they don't know it, but they've made a permanent enemy out of England. And in that sense, we're in the same spot as the Japanese people. So these whites here in Southern Africa, and this includes the Boers who should know better, all of us don't realize and don't take seriously the fact that Britain is our enemy. And every action of the British here in Africa has been anti-white. And this, despite the whites of Southern Africa having volunteered to fight for the English in all their world wars against Germany and others like Japan. But what it shows you is how stupid we have been. We have got nobody to blame except ourselves. We should have known better, but we've been fooling ourselves, kidding ourselves, and lying to ourselves. And to this day, there are large numbers of these old people who still don't get it, that England stabs you in the back. And for the record, the Japanese also ended up fighting Russia in Asia for a short while. But the Russians put their very best troops on the Asian front, and the Japanese had a hard time there. I did a video late last year, and I called it How America Built UFOs, Part 1. And I never got round to completing Part 2, even though I have all the material for Part 2. And I should complete Part 2 but we have many other things to do first. Now, part one contained National Geographic footage, which is banned in certain countries via YouTube. So most people can't see part one. And I did an unblocked version, which took out the video but allowed the audio. However, you can find the proper version on my History Reviewed channel on archive.org. And what I'm about to tell you ties back to that video, How America Built UFOs, Part 1. In that video, I told you that there was a lot of stuff about military secrecy that people did not appreciate. Now, in recent videos, I've mentioned that maybe I should deal with some military matters more. And I did see that one of the viewers said that he thought it would be a good idea. So as we move forward, we will touch more and more on military matters and warfare and actually dig into this in a way that they just don't do at school, etc. They just don't come down to the bone and start really getting into the minds of these commanders and what's going on. So there's a lot of real meat that's missing from all these stories about military things. Now, in that video about how America built UFOs, I had film footage from a National Geographic expose of what America got up to at Area 51, which had been declassified in 2011. I think it was declassified in 2011. And I also told of my own experiences in the little bit of a military career that I had at Naval HQ and about how you handle secret and top secret files and that sort of thing. How does secrecy work in the real world? So this video gave you all the insight into that and what had been declassified. Now that video that I did proved to be quite unpopular. People were not very interested in what I was saying in that video. But what you're about to see is going to show you yet again that that thesis is correct, that what I was telling you is correct. And I urge people to take the time to look at that video, part one, because when I have some time later on, I'll do part two, because part two is much simpler to do, and part two will also show you straight up front. It'll show you straight up front things that most of you probably didn't think existed, but which have in fact been built, and there's film footage and details about it. So as we move forward, I'll try to show you trickery, I'll try to show you cunning, I'll try to show you genius at work, I'll try to show you all sorts of things that have happened, but because our history teachers and our school system is not doing their job properly, people just aren't appreciating what really went on. And there are people now and then who go and read those history books and they study them very closely, and you'll find that there were guys who were unknown, guys like Napoleon, guys like Adolf Hitler, guys like George Lincoln Rockwell in America, somebody who's totally unknown, and he's busy reading and studying and thinking, and then suddenly it hits him like a thunderbolt. This is the truth. This is reality. Here is knowledge that I can use. And he uses that knowledge, and he goes on to do something great. Napoleon said that you can use history as a way of getting inspiration. He knew exactly what he was talking about. Napoleon and Hitler both studied history, and they studied history for its inspiration and its proper knowledge. And you'll notice that lots of this history, they try and take it out of the current school system, they dumb the kids down, they're trying to fool the children, they're trying to get everybody away from real knowledge. Now, in that video about UFOs, I mentioned to people how secrecy actually works and how you can hide things from vast numbers of people and fool vast numbers of people very easily. And you can even make large numbers of people tell lies. I used to be very interested in UFOs. And you know what I used to say to myself when I was younger? I used to say to myself, surely not everybody is a liar. Not everybody is a liar. There's got to be somebody telling the truth. Wrong. Wrong. Everybody can be a liar. That is one of the shocking things about life. In fact, the more I study everything, the more I realize that it's lies, lies, and more lies. And the number of people who make a living based on nothing but lying, the number of organizations that exist based on nothing but lies, it is shocking. If you want to know why the world is a mess, it's because there are so many liars, and they've got so much money, and they get so much publicity. Then when somebody finds the truth, and the poor guy who finds the truth and has the guts to try and tell the truth, he is demonized. So you get a guy like Adolf Hitler, who merely tried to tell certain truths, and for that the man was demonized from top to bottom, vilified for everything he said. And yet, see if you can find proof that Adolf Hitler told even one lie. There is a quote attributed to Mark Twain that says, a lie can travel halfway around the earth while the truth is still putting on its boots. I did a bit of digging, and a website called quoteinvestigator.com says that there is no proof that Mark Twain ever said this. But they say that the author, Jonathan Swift, did write about this in the year 1710. And since on this channel we deal with lies a lot, let me read to you what Jonathan Swift wrote in 1710, because this applies to this channel a lot. It says, besides, as the vilest writer has his readers, so the greatest liar has his believers. And it often happens that if a lie be believed only for an hour, it has done its work, and there is no further occasion for it. Falsehood flies, and the truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late, the jest is over, and the tale has had its effect. So that is what Jonathan Swift wrote in 1710, and isn't that so true? And then this researcher dug around some more, and they found a collection of sermons by a guy called Thomas Franklin. And this is from 1787. And he wrote, falsehood will fly, as it were, on the wings of the wind, and carry its tales to every corner of the earth. While truth lags behind, her steps, though sure, are slow and solemn, and she has neither vigor nor activity enough to pursue and overtake her enemy. So here, the pastor says that the truth moves very slowly compared to the lie. But as I said in my video, Jews 102, The Jewish Strategy of Lying, white people build civilization based on the truth. And science and civilization and all these other things, these are our creations. And it turns out that there are many similar types of quotes. Here's another one, for example. For falsehood will fly from Maine to Georgia while truth is pulling her boots on. And so it carries on. There's actually a stack of such quotes by different people. So this is important for the Jews because the Jews move fast. They need to tell the lie, they need to get in there, and they know that the rest of us will take 100 years to catch up. But it gets even worse than that. Turns out that it may take more than 2,000 years, maybe even 3,000 years, for the truth to catch up. Only now are we finding out what was happening in Babylon almost 3,000 years ago. And only now do we discover it's a lie. So returning to that video about UFOs, and bear with me because this is very relevant to what we are doing here. I went through the whole process of describing how military people can keep secrets better than anybody else, and how large numbers of people can keep secrets. And then you were shown how, when those secrets start coming out, how they can be shut down completely, like in the case of people who were on aircraft that saw spy planes that they shouldn't have seen, that when those people landed at airports in America, they were met by the FBI, and the FBI made them sign certain documents, and then those people had to keep their mouths shut or else they'd go to jail. And how effective this was. This turned commercial pilots into liars, and people would openly tell lies because the alternative was a jail sentence. Now, one of my viewers, one of my regular firm viewers from Europe, from Germany in fact, he made a remark on that video where he said that something like several hundred thousand, I'm not sure if it was 400,000 people worked on the atomic bomb, for example, and other secret things in America. And he finds it really hard to believe that you can keep secrets on that sort of scale. And I differed because I say that secrets can be kept, and you'll be shocked at how well they are kept. Now, in that video, we were dealing with military secrets. And military secrets are the ones that have got the most formal process and the best processes for keeping them secret. But you'll be astounded at how many secrets are kept that aren't even military and that aren't even under the threat of a jail sentence, and yet they were kept too. I do have one final point I want to make about that video that I did about how America built UFOs, part one. When I had finished the video, I went and I hunted for some articles about the old guys in it who were interviewed. The guys whose work had been declassified. And I didn't mention this in the video, but I'd like to mention it now because it just adds more to this tale of how secrets are kept. It turns out that almost every single one of those old men in that documentary in that National Geographic documentary that I think every single one of them died by 2013. I think every single one of those men you saw interviewed and whose life stories was told died by 2013. And if you dig into their history, you'll see that at the time of this documentary, they were actually very ill. These old guys were very ill and they didn't last long. And you'll find various references to this. And it may be that part of the reason why they did that documentary was because they knew of their age, they knew of their ill health, and they decided that this is declassified and they can tell their story now because they're not going to be around for long and it needs to be told for posterity. So you may be wondering what all this discussion of mine is about and what is it leading to? Well, it's leading to a story of deception. Now, in the case of the Jews, I've mentioned the concept of magic, that you must also look at these Jews as magicians. In fact, Monica Stone of the South Africa Project, she's been at this for many decades of her life. And the word that she uses is illusion. She says, everything is an illusion. Nothing is real. Everything is an illusion. And illusion is what magicians do. And there is so much illusion going on in this world today. We live in a world of illusion. And as I've said before in one of my other videos, I mentioned that you may be standing there in front of two doors. And the one door looks like it's the steel door of a vault. And the other door looks like a wooden door. And you think to yourself, of these two doors, the one that I'm going to try and break through is the one that is wooden. And so you try and break through the wood door, but you find you can't break through it. It's so tough. But it never occurs to you to maybe take a rock and throw a rock at what appears to be a steel door, because the two doors are actually just painted to look that way. What looks like wood was really steel, and what looks like steel was really glass. And if you chucked a rock at the steel door, you find the steel door shatters. And goodness me, that was the easiest path. And I mentioned that with regard to things like racism. The Jews keep saying to you, the wooden door, the wooden door, go through the wooden door. And you keep going for the wooden door. Meanwhile, the real door, the door that will lead to freedom and success, is the one that you keep avoiding because you think that that is the door that is hardest to go through. And yet it's not. It's actually the secret door that will lead you to success. But constantly, they are misleading you towards the door that won't work, because they want you to fail. That's all part of the game. So in this world, in this modern world, there is so much intellectual rubbish. There's so much garbage that masquerades as fact. There's so much garbage that masquerades as reality. And this garbage is messing up people's lives. This garbage is messing up the world. This garbage is messing up whole nations of people. And in the last couple of days, I was thinking about people I know personally whose lives were completely wasted and destroyed by them believing in rubbish. My oldest sister died at the age of 56, And one day I'll tell you the story of my oldest sister and how her life was ruined by absolute rubbish. My oldest sister was a very beautiful girl, a very intelligent woman, very sensitive girl. She should have had a perfect life. Her life turned into an absolute ruin. And I was thinking of another woman I knew. About 4 years ago, I met another woman. And we became friends. And earlier in her life, she'd been a competition dancer. She had absolutely everything going for her. Looks, brains, money, everything. Absolutely everything. But she was completely dysfunctional. And you know what? She was reading all these modern things, all these concepts that are pushed by all these magazines and modern TV and radio and all the quotes in crowd. She was adopting all these values, and these values were killing her. They were destroying her life. She couldn't think straight. I went to her Facebook page yesterday and saw the last photo of her that she'd put up, and I just shook my head. Here she is. She's going to die alone. She's going to be a woman who's felt that life was a waste for her. She never found love. She never had children. She never had happiness. She never had success. And she's confused and she's unhappy. And why? Because she's listening to too much rubbish. And this stuff that they are putting out, this stuff is killing people. And it's not just killing one or two people. It is making the entire world sick. And the people who are the sickest of all are the people in civilized countries. People don't know up from down. They don't know left from right. They've been so confused because the liars are ruling the roost. So behind all these facades all around the world, there may be a lot more that is a total fallacy and totally incorrect than you can believe. And I come across these things again and again and again everywhere I look. A week ago, I phoned a really old guy in America. He's 96 and he's almost totally blind. And he's one of the handful of people who knew the American Nazi George Lincoln Rockwell personally. And in the story of George Lincoln Rockwell, you'll hear how Rockwell and his Nazis were arrested and chucked in jail. And everybody thinks, ah, how sad those American Nazis were chucked in jail. So this old guy tells me that on one of those occasions, he went to the police station where these Nazis were in jail. And when he got there, the cell doors were open. The Nazis were walking around talking to the police, and the Nazis and the police were all joking together. Because officially the Nazis are in jail, but in practice the police knew they were the good guys, and the police knew that they'd done nothing wrong. And so they, quotes, put them in jail because those were their orders. But in practice, the Nazis could walk around and do what they want. And the police knew that these Nazis were good guys. And if you watch my video, How to Fight Jews Legally, you'll see the story of Snowy Smith here in South Africa. And you'll get a chance to see what the Jews write about him, what the newspapers write about him. And then I show you the documents and the interview that I did with him. And we compare what actually happened versus what the Jews and the liberals say happened. So one of the things that you need to start opening your mind to is that a lot of what you see is illusion. And now the problem becomes trying to detect where the illusion starts and where the illusion ends, and which thing is what, and what exactly does it mean. Because you think that we're in a jail, but most of that is itself an illusion. Yes, we are in a jail, and everything appears to be a brick wall around us or bars around us, but there may be escape routes that are actually quite easy. There are certain escape routes that are there, but they are hidden from you. Now you need to go and probe that wall and look and touch it and kick it and see, is every part of this brick wall really made of brick? Or is there a part of it that's got a hole that's covered with cardboard that's painted to look like a brick? So let's return to President Roosevelt. Because President Roosevelt engaged in a deception. President Roosevelt was surrounded by communists and Jews, and this guy was kind of a weirdo as well. He even married his cousin. So Roosevelt married Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, his fifth cousin once removed. So if you go and you look into the Roosevelts, they're kind of weird, and there are some Jewish links and other weirdness there. And this cousin that he married, she became a big-time supporter of communist agitation later after he died. She had a sort of a clandestine political career, and she was all against whites. She played a role messing around in Africa and helping communists all over. Now, Roosevelt himself engaged in a deception that you would not normally think you could pull off. And that's what makes the Roosevelt deception so astounding, is it is yet another example of something that is in your face. It's in your face, and yet you miss it. Now, Roosevelt is interesting in this topic regarding Japan, because Roosevelt is the guy who led America into World War II. He's the guy who fought the Germans and the Japanese, and he did a bunch of underhanded, sneaky things, which we're going to examine when we look at how Japan got into World War II. But I wanted to show you that he was a sneaky, underhanded guy, and he was damn good at it. Now, a thing that most people miss in this world is they miss the subtlety of certain things. I've brought this topic up regarding the Jews time and again, and you're going to see it in this deception of Roosevelt. And when I was chatting to Monica Stone, I was saying to her that one of the problems that a lot of people have is they struggle to grasp the subtlety of some of our enemies. But I think I may have the answer to this. One of my friends found a book, and it's a book about narcissists, but it's not the normal kind of book you'd get on narcissists. And as I was reading this, and this pal of mine told me about his experiences and how much this book had taught him and helped him in his life, then I began to see, what you are seeing here is a modus operandi that is exactly like the Jews. And all of these things tie together. Once you start seeing how subtle and sneaky people can be, they can be so subtle and sneaky right under your nose. You won't believe you've just been fooled. And there's a lot of this stuff that's gone on. And in the case of America and World War II, there's a whole deception that Winston Churchill and Roosevelt engaged in, which was aimed at making Americans hate the Germans. That in itself was an entire project. It was a huge thing. They poured money into it. They hired people. And some of those people have been interviewed and have told their stories of some of the things that they were doing, how they went on a campaign to make white Americans hate the Germans. And that was very successful, conducted on American territory by Churchill with the connivance of Roosevelt, and it was run from the Rockefeller building. Now let's look closely at this deception of Roosevelt. The deception is very basic, actually, and it's something you'd think you can't hide. President Roosevelt suffered from polio, and he couldn't walk. So this guy couldn't walk as a result of an illness. However, in order to get back into politics, he decided that he needed to be able to walk and to convince everybody that he was getting better and that he could now walk. And he engaged in a deception whereby he, though he was wheelchair-ridden, he would fool everybody into thinking he wasn't ill and he could walk. And he succeeded. He fooled all of the American public. He fooled most of the world. But I do hear that he didn't fool the Germans. Apparently, Hitler and his seniors referred to Roosevelt as a cripple. The Germans knew he was a cripple, but everybody else and almost all of America thought he wasn't a cripple. Now, isn't that an enormous lie that you have successfully pulled off? You fooled your entire nation into thinking that you can walk. Is that something you would be capable of doing? Most normal people would never even think of it. In Mein Kampf, Hitler says that most people are used to telling small lies, but they can never imagine that somebody would tell an enormous lie, that the lie would be so enormous, so bold, so blatant, and yet they would do it. And yet in the case of Roosevelt, he set out to do that. Here's a man who's in a wheelchair. How is he going to convince everybody that he's not in a wheelchair, that he can walk? And how is he going to not only pull it off into fooling them, how's he going to keep it a secret? Because even if you fooled them once or twice, how are you going to keep this a secret for years? And yet, President Roosevelt was totally and utterly successful. He fooled the vast majority of Americans, probably fooled hundreds of millions of people worldwide, maybe billions, and they kept it a secret all the time. And there was no official military requirement or government requirement to keep it a secret, yet the secret was kept in a, quote, open society, in a society where people move around and see things and so forth. Yet this secret was kept right in your face. Close-up magic. Close-up magic. The magician is standing right in front of you and he's fooling you. So let's read a little bit about Roosevelt's illness. It says in Wikipedia, Franklin D. Roosevelt's paralytic illness. It says, Franklin D. Roosevelt's paralytic illness began in 1921 when the future president of the United States was 39 years of age and vacationing with his family at their summer home in Campobello Island. Roosevelt was diagnosed with poliomyelitis 2 weeks after he felt ill. He was left with permanent paralysis from the waist down and was unable to stand or walk without support. Despite the lack of a cure for paralysis, he tried a wide range of therapies, and his belief in the benefits of hydrotherapy led him to found a center at Warm Springs, Georgia in 1926. He laboriously taught himself to walk short distances while wearing iron braces on his hips and legs by swiveling his torso, supporting himself with a cane, and he was careful never to be seen using his wheelchair in public. His bout with illness was well known before and during his presidency and became a major part of his image, but the extent of his paralysis was kept from public view. So they knew he was ill, but they hid the extent to which his illness had damaged him, and the public, the American public, apparently almost all the American public, didn't know that FDR couldn't walk. However, Adolf Hitler and others did know he was an invalid. So now what's interesting are the tricks and methods by which he hid his illness and how he managed to fool people. And the first time I came across this was when I was watching a documentary about underground cities. And in there, they mentioned that there was a special railway station built at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. And this railway station underground was hidden from view, and it was built only for Roosevelt. This was so that Roosevelt would never be seen getting into or out of a car. So when he goes to New York, his car just drives out of the hotel. And when they showed film footage of him, he was always seated, but never in a wheelchair. And this secret was kept during his campaign and his presidency, and it only came out later. But, as those authors mention at the beginning of this video, the fact is that as long as the lie lasts for the period of time that it's needed, then it has served its purpose. Though I might add, the shocking, shocking, shocking lesson of history and science is the extent to which a lie can be kept alive for thousands of years. Thousands of years. So it turns out that there is also no film footage of him in his wheelchair during his presidency. But what I managed to get was various bits of film footage where they discuss and they show you this deception by Roosevelt, including one bit of film footage where he actually walks. With all that trickery of his, he manages to appear to be walking, and he looks quite good. You can't believe that this is a man who can't walk, and yet he pulls it off. And look also at the techniques, him using his son and his cane and his arduous practice that gave him the ability to pull off this feat so that he can walk short distances and be filmed walking slowly for short distances, and that's all that's needed to fool everybody into thinking he's okay. And then you'll see when he's busy checking the troops that instead of walking and inspecting the troops, he happens to be riding on a jeep. And ask yourself, how many people then ask themselves the question, why is the president on a jeep. Why isn't he walking and inspecting the troops? But nobody asks. So then you have to sit back and just look at the techniques and say to yourself, look at how carefully everything has been choreographed so that the public are fooled. Have a look at these video excerpts, and then I'll chat a little bit more after that. But go and have a look at this, and look at all this evidence of a nice deception in a free country, in a free country, the country known for its freedom, the country known for the openness of its society. And yet, here is a politician, and look at how easily he gets everybody to work with him and how well they lie to and fool all of America for a good number of years.
When we think of a president giving an address, that in and of itself is meaningful and stressful enough. But with Franklin Roosevelt, there's this added complication of him having to create the illusion that he could walk.
FDR always felt that that it would be a political liability if he were seen as this kind of helpless man in a wheelchair.
Ever since he was inflicted with polio in 1921, he was determined to develop a way of walking so, as he said, he didn't scare the hell out of people. Probably around 11 o'clock or so, his valet, Arthur Prettyman, started preparing him for his major address.
This means getting dressed. Well, getting dressed for Roosevelt was an arduous task. It will take him about an hour.
Life was an effort for this man. The kinds of things that we take for granted, getting dressed in the morning, walking, leaving aside the things that we don't have to do, writing speeches to rally a nation at war. He couldn't put his pants on. Imagine, you know, the indignities of this, and yet the strength of the man at the center of the story.
Prettyman had a routine. He would take Roosevelt and lie him flat on his back on the bed. And the first thing he would do is put on his braces. And the purpose of the brace is to lock his legs in, to make them completely stiff so they can't bend.
The braces were strapped both at the knee and the thighs. They were pulled as tight as possible to give Roosevelt a very stiff-legged gait.
The next thing he would do is put on his shoes. So he put on his socks and his black shoes.
Then the pants had to be put on over the shoes and over the braces. This was a very difficult process of swaying Roosevelt and moving Roosevelt back and forth as the pants were maneuvered first over the shoes, then over the braces, and then pulled up to his waist.
Once the pants were on, he would pick him up off the bed and put him back into his wheelchair.
And when it came to his so-called walking, really he wasn't walking at all. Essentially what Roosevelt tried to do was to cover up the extent of his disability.
And he does it by using his son's arm as one might a parallel bar, and also would use a cane in the other hand.
He would move by essentially throwing his body weight forward.
Because he couldn't move his legs. His legs were actually locked in these braces. They were like poles, and they were lifeless. And so he would lunge forward with his shoulders and use his upper body to drag himself forward.
James would take a step forward, the crutch would move forward, the braces would swing forward. James, crutch, braces. James, crutch, braces.
It almost created the appearance that he was walking.
He once confessed that he considered himself one of the greatest actors in the nation. And he was one of the greatest actors, because once those braces were put on, once he was finally prepped, once he was finally dressed, he was not a helpless man in a wheelchair. He was the leader of what would be the most significant military alliance the world had ever seen.
Recently discovered film footage shows President Franklin Delano Roosevelt being pushed in a wheelchair, depicting a secret not revealed to the public until after his death. A Franklin College professor found the 8-second clip while doing research in the National Archives. It shows Roosevelt on the USS Baltimore at Pearl Harbor in July of 1944. 9 months before his death, and just weeks after the Allied invasion of Normandy, France. The wheelchair is not clearly visible, but its motion is. The FDR Presidential Museum and Library and the National Archives both say such footage is rare. Roosevelt contracted polio in 1921 at age 39 and did not publicly appear in a wheelchair throughout his presidency. The FDR Museum says news photographers cooperated in concealing his disability. Bob McCall, Associated Press.
Throughout his long struggle with polio, Franklin remained determined to return to politics. But he knew he would have to convince voters that he was not an invalid, and year after year of arduous exercise had not improved his wasted leg muscles.
He wanted to be president, and it was just unthinkable in those days that a person in a wheelchair could be elected president of the United States. In fact, it's pretty unthinkable right now. And so he had to walk. And since he wasn't getting better, he developed better techniques for appearing to look better.
In 1926, physiotherapist Alice Converse taught Franklin how to walk more effectively with crutches.
He was very anxious to walk. He would plant the crutches on the floor so hard you'd think the boards would break. And then drag himself along. It had been 5 years since the onset of polio. His upper body was very strong, but his legs were pretty weak. So we tried to get him to use his body muscles in such a way that they would help lift up a leg at a time and take a step.
But crutches weren't good enough. He knew they were political poison. They would, he said, inspire pity. He learned instead to appear in public with a cane.
And he developed this technique that looked like walking. His sons were strong men. They took exercises so their arms would be as strong as a parallel bar. And he would lean on one son's arm, putting all his weight on him. And then he would switch his weight from the son's arm onto a cane, which he carried in the other hand, so that he could switch his weight from side to side and thus progress. And he instructed his sons, you must not let people see that this is difficult or takes effort or it hurts. They would chat and joke and laugh as they went along. It was a slow process. But they looked as though they were taking their time so they could smile at people and say hello to the crowd as they went along. And it was showbiz, but it worked.
Only 4 seconds of film exist which clearly show the walk Franklin so tirelessly practiced.
The goal really was simply to take enough steps to get from a car into a building or from his seat on the stage to the podium and back again. If he could do that without seeming hopelessly crippled, he'd succeeded.
Roosevelt had no hip muscles, and if a breeze, someone should jostle him, something like that, he could just pivot and fall down. He was not stable at all. It was not a safe way of locomotion, of moving around. Not a practical way, but it was a political way.
By the summer of 1928, Franklin was ready at last to make his way back into the political world. The Democratic convention was in Houston, and Eleanor had written him, "I'm telling everyone you're going to Houston without crutches." As he boarded the train for Texas, he knew he was about to risk everything. All through through the 1920s, Franklin had kept up his contacts with Democratic Party leaders. Now he'd been asked to nominate the governor of New York, Al Smith, for president. Smith was a tough, worldly Catholic from New York City, and one of his advisors argued, "You're a Bowery Mick and he's a Protestant patrician. He'll take some of the curse off you." With 15,000 delegates watching, Franklin set out to walk to the podium with a cane, without the aid of crutches. An accidental fall would leave him sprawled helplessly on the convention floor, his political hopes destroyed. With one hand, he gripped the cane. With the other, he balanced precariously on his son Elliot's powerful arm. He appeared to be walking. One reporter described the scene. "Here on the stage is Franklin Roosevelt, a figure tall and proud even in suffering, pale with years of struggle against paralysis, a man softened and cleansed and illumined with pain. For the moment, we are lifted up.
We offer one who has the will to win, who not only deserves success, but commands it. Victory is his habit. The happy warrior, Alfred E. Smith."
The nomination was Al Smith's, but the victory belonged to Franklin Roosevelt. When Smith urged him to run for governor of New York, Roosevelt said he was ready. Someone asked Smith why he had put Roosevelt back in the political limelight. "Aren't you raising up a rival who will one day cause you trouble?" "No," Smith replied. "He'll be dead within a year." 6 months later, Smith had lost his run for the presidency, and Roosevelt was governor of New York. Roosevelt won office by the slimmest of margins, campaigning more vigorously than anyone expected. Now, as governor, he would continue to surprise everyone. He took command at once. In his first 6 months, he advocated tax relief for farmers and cheap electric power for consumers. But when disaster suddenly struck the economy, no one was sure what Roosevelt would do.
I met up again with Metro North's Dan Brook.
Good to see you again, Dan.
Yeah, good to see you, especially here, right outside the Waldorf Astoria.
He was bringing me into another one of New York's hidden subterranean faces.
In the basement of this Waldorf Astoria, it is dark, it's murky, it is dirty, and yet it served one of the most important VIP guests in the world.
Can you take me to it?
I want to show it to you right now.
All right, let's do it, Dan.
Dan, this does not look like VIP. This is the anti-Waldorf, the grandest hotel in the city. And this looks like a boneyard.
This secret train station was built during the Great Depression by the New York Central Company.
There's a very good reason for it being secret. And it definitely has a very important tale to tell. Even though they spent a lot of money on carving out and creating this train station, they knew that customers were never going to get on from this train station. So why build it? It was meant and designed to serve Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt was first elected president of the United States in 1932. 11 years earlier, he was stricken with polio and his legs were paralyzed throughout his presidency. He hid his condition from the public.
it was to be kept secret that he had polio. Actually, the public had very little idea that he had polio. Very few people knew this. There was a handshake agreement with the press that he was not to be seen, photographed, shown that way.
Today, keeping such a condition secret would be nearly impossible. But in the 1930s, Roosevelt pulled it off with the help of this station.
So this was a secret location for him to arrive in New York City, for him to leave New York City, with never being seen having to get out of an automobile by the press.
Roosevelt had a special train that would carry him into this secret station. And in order to get to the Waldorf Hotel above, he might never have had to leave his limo.
He would be sitting in his limousine on a specific train car designed to carry his limousine. A ramp would come out, we pulled right out here, and then would be driven directly into this elevator.
Now hold on right here. Are you talking an automobile going in here?
That is correct. This elevator is designed to haul 8,000 pounds for this armor-clad Pierce Arrow limousine.
The train station I was standing in was completely separate from the rest of New York's subway system, but it sat just 1,000 feet away from Grand Central Terminal. As Dan explained, a specially designed train car would begin its journey from Washington, D.C. Inside the train was a Pierce Arrow limousine carrying the crippled president. Once the train arrived at this platform, a ramp would come out, allowing the limo to drive directly into the elevator that brought Roosevelt 12 stories up into the luxurious Waldorf Astoria Hotel, his home away from home in New York. There's more. Farther down, there's an unidentified train car on a shadowy storage track. But this is no ordinary train. Dan told me this mysterious train car first arrived on this platform at the end of World War II, shortly after Franklin Roosevelt died. And for more than 60 years, this train car's origin and purpose has remained a mystery.
We know that it's a train car that was built in the 20s or the 1930s. We know it was designed to carry private automobiles. What we call the trucks or the wheel assemblies,
okay, right here,
are vastly over-engineered and overbuilt.
It's evidence that whatever this train was carrying, it was very heavy, with very precious cargo.
This is a steel plate that just from this vantage point is at least an inch thick, with rivets everywhere.
Yeah, the entire body of this thing is virtually armor-clad. Obviously, it's protecting something far more important than a Pierce Arrow.
It had a steel armor-clad body and windows almost unheard of for its time.
These are many, many layers of extra thick panels of multiple layers of glass all fused together, which was the only way they could make what was essentially bulletproof glass.
Sure, back in the 20s and 30s, how are they going to make it? They don't have that technology.
Other special features on the car suggest that armed guards also rode inside.
On the very top of that train car, there is a belief that those areas could serve as gun ports within this train car. And perhaps one of the biggest mysteries, nowhere in our system do we have a train car with this number. And it ends with a telltale X. That X means that the train car is not owned by the railroad. More often than not, it is owned by the federal government. When you piece it all together, it makes sense to us that this car could only serve one purpose and one person, and that is Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
So I hope you found that interesting. I don't know how many Americans know that at the time that Roosevelt was alive, that this had been a secret. But I thought this is quite a massive secret to keep, and to keep it from so many people. And look at how successful it was. And look even at the journalists and the other people who met him in person and who knew that this was the case. Look at how nobody broke the silence. Nobody. And it makes me think of Napoleon when he said, 10 people who speak make more noise than 10,000 who are silent. Interestingly enough, I checked up on that quote And while I was checking up on it, it turns out that the quote, "a picture is worth a thousand words," is actually a quote from Napoleon. How many times have you heard it said, "a picture is worth a thousand words"? That comes from Napoleon. But you need to ponder how Roosevelt was able to get people to cooperate with him and to agree and to all keep the secret. But now in his case, he was a paraplegic. And no doubt that probably was a key thing that helped him to win people over. So then think about the Jews and all their sob stories, all their lies about, oh, we're so persecuted, everyone's trying to kill us, and they never give us a fair chance, and how that too must be working for them like a bomb. People will do all sorts of things out of sympathy for other people. But that's where the Jews really are top-notch, because they win sympathy from you while stabbing you in your back. And that makes them a whole different kettle of fish. I'm curious to know how many Americans find this to be new to them. Perhaps it's already something that's old news to almost everybody in America. I don't know. But it is interesting that this guy kept a deception at the time that he was in office, and it was kept across the country. So sit back, and I hope that this makes you think again about deception and how lies and secrets are kept, and how easily hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of people are fooled. And they're fooled for long, for years, and sometimes much, much longer. And it's almost scary. It's almost scary how the truth struggles to catch up. And that, no doubt, is also part of the reason why the truth is so valuable. But I'm a firm believer that it is a simple fact of life and mechanics and science and engineering and that sort of thing that no progress is possible based on lies. You cannot progress based on lies. You can only progress based on the truth. And it's not just true for one person, it's true for entire nations, for races, for civilizations. You cannot progress based on lies. You have to know facts. Because if you make decisions based on lies, you don't move forward. Here in Africa, the blacks are doing that all the time, and they can't understand why they're not succeeding. The truth is utterly, utterly critical, and it's been one of the key things of the white race. And if we took the truth more seriously, I believe we'd progress a lot faster. And there have been enormous errors where we've lost sight of the truth. But the other thing to think about with regard to Roosevelt is look at the detail. Look at how you go about mechanically hiding certain things. Notice how in all the different situations in which he appeared as the president, where he had to be in public and he had to be filmed, how they had to prepare it and how they had to set it up so that everything would look natural to you. And you wouldn't suspect that this guy is wheelchair bound. And I think if they can lie to you about something so straightforward and so obvious and so natural, I could not get away with that. You could not get away with that. And yet this guy got away with it. And if they can lie about something like that and everybody hide it, and hide it from all of America and from hundreds of millions of people outside America, you need to sit and think about that. That is quite scary. And notice the detail and the attention to detail that went into this and how they pulled this thing off. Now, in one of those short videos, the one guy said, well, you know, they pulled it off in those days, but they wouldn't be able to pull it off in this day and age of these open societies. Stop, stop, stop that bus. No, it is possible to lie even more now. Don't come and tell me that you can't pull that off today. The only people who might be able to help counter that might be individuals on the internet, like we've seen with 9/11, for example, or World War II, where individuals come and they start standing up for it. And many of those people are silenced, some are jailed, all kinds of things happen to them. And you don't see the mass media running around saying, oh, you know what, there was this guy on the internet and he told the truth about the Holocaust. Or there was this guy on the internet and he told the truth about 9/11. No, they don't. They all lie together in unison. The structure is there and the lying structure stays at work. I don't think you can in any way, shape or form say that governments and the media today couldn't pull off a trick like that. They could pull off 100 tricks like that. And the people who truly stand for the truth, they're the ones who'll be vilified. So I don't buy the notion that we are any better off than the people were back then. And any hope that we have doesn't come from the politicians. It doesn't come from the mass media. It doesn't even come from these professors and universities. What it does come from is the fact that we have access to the internet, and it's the one place where we more or less have freedom. That is the only thing that gives me any hope. And for me, the most important thing is that we are allowed to say our thing, and that censorship against us on the internet does not increase. That is the most important thing of all. All these other people in power, all the rich, the politicians, the wealthy, all of these people, for them, lying still continues as in the past. In fact, if not worse, and they can't stop lying about the Germans. World War II is a lie that they have to continuously talk about all the time. They have to keep hammering you with new programs and new documentaries reinforcing the previous lies of World War II. They have to carry on like that over and over again in case we sit back and large numbers of people break free from it. I don't see any reason to believe that the system will change itself, to believe that the system is suddenly, after 100 years of lying, or 70 years of lying since World War II, all of a sudden they're all going to tell the truth. Are you kidding me? No way, man. I've seen enough of life, and I've been in organizations where an organization has a certain problem. In my case, because of the technical nature of my work, I'd see them make a decision at management level that I don't like, that I think is bad for the kind of work that I'm doing. And I go and I say to people and I say to managers, listen, you've made a bad decision. This thing is worse than before. Go back and use the product we were using before. And I have had endless hassles over that kind of thing. In the end, that system comes back and it fights you. That system will never change its decision. The only way you're going to get that system to change is by overthrowing that system. You're going to have to change that system. You're going to have to find a way to seize political control of that system and then change the rules. Whether you gain control of that political system through voting or whether you overthrow it in some other way, but until you get political power, you are not going to see that system change. Systems don't change. Once a structure is there, that structure fights for itself. It never does it any other way. It will fight until you destroy it and replace it with something better. Change doesn't come from the inside. If you want to change it from the inside, your other option is infiltration. You have to infiltrate it and start getting people to work together in unison and chip away at it here and there. So you only have one of three options. Either you change the political system by going through the process and getting elected, or you overthrow it violently, or you infiltrate it and you change it through infiltration. Those are your only three mechanisms for changing an institution. Never assume that thing is going to change itself. And especially when there are so many people and so many things dependent on it. The Jews are so dependent on that Holocaust lie, they're never going to change that thing. They will fight tooth and nail to keep that thing at all costs. And all the things related to World War II, all of those lies are embedded there. And don't be surprised to see those structures coming to reinforce all the old lies about World War II. So I hope that this gave you a bit of insight into Roosevelt, his determination. Look, you've got to hand it to the guy. He was determined. But this guy had a lust for power and an agenda of his own. He had the determination to do it, and it shows you the cunning, sneaky things he was willing to do. This was a man who would stop at nothing to get to power and to use that power. You can see the raw determination in this guy, and when something stood in his way, he snuck around it. And he was very sneaky, very cunning, very determined. So that's the personality that you're dealing with when you sit and consider how America got into World War II. So we'll be heading down the path of looking at Pearl Harbor and the Japanese and how it was that Pearl Harbor came about. And Pearl Harbor has since become something of an institution because 9/11 was referred to by the Jews as a modern Pearl Harbor. So Pearl Harbor has become the means by which Americans can excuse attacking another nation. And we'll have a look at this man who led America towards war with Japan and how exactly these people did it. And of course, there's Churchill. Churchill, just as sneaky, just as underhanded. Churchill needed America in World War II, so he needed to find a way to get America in. And there were Americans and Jews who needed to find a way to get America into World War II. And so that's what we'll be studying, is how they set the Japanese up and how a number of countries, but mostly it was America and Britain, but Holland also played a role in it. But America and Britain were the main ones who were trying to get America into World War II, and they needed to get Japan to do something that they could then use as their big excuse. So that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. Take care of yourselves. We'll be chatting again soon.
Thank you.